why. Out of revenge, Cal extracted a fluid of power, and out of power, joy. It was the strongest, purest emotion he knew. Far from disliking Aaron, he loved him, because he was usually the cause for Cal's feeling of triumph. He had forgotten, if he had ever known, that he punished because he wished he could be loved as Aaron was loved. It had gone so far that he preferred what he had to what Aaron had. Abra had started a process in Cal by touching Aaron and by the softness of her voice toward him. Cal's reaction was automatic. His brain probed for a weakness in Abra, and so clever was he that he found one almost at once in her words. Some children want to be babies, and some want to be adults. Few are content with their age. Abra wanted to be an adult. She used adult words and simulated, insofar as she was able, adult attitudes and emotions. She had left babyhood far behind, and she wasn't capable yet of being one of the grown-ups she admired. Cal sensed this, and it gave him the instrument to knock down her anthill. He knew about how long it would take his brother to find the box. He could see in his mind what would happen. Aaron would try to wash the blood off the rabbit, and this would take time. Finding string would take more time, and the careful tying of the bow knots still more time. And meanwhile, Cal knew he was beginning to win. He felt Abra's certainty wavering, and he knew that he could prod it further. Abra looked away from him at last and said, "What do you stare at a person for?" Cal looked at her feet and slowly raised his eyes, going over her as coldly as if she were a chair. This, he knew, could make even an adult nervous. Abra couldn't stand it. She said, "See anything green?" Cal asked, "Do you go to school?" "Of course I do." "What grade?" "High fifth." "How old are you?" "Going on 11?" Cal laughed. "What's wrong with that?" she demanded. He didn't answer her. "Come on, tell me, what's wrong with that?" Still no answer. "You think you're mighty smart," she said. And when he continued to laugh at her, she said uneasily, "I wonder what's taking your brother so long." "Look, the rain stopped." Cal said, "I guess he's looking around for it." "You mean for the rabbit?" "Oh, no, he's got that all right. It's dead. But maybe he can't catch the other. It gets away."
"Catch what? What gets away?"
"He wouldn't want me to tell," said Cal. "He wants it to be a surprise. He caught it last Friday. It bit him, too."
"Whatever are you talking about?"
"You'll see," said Cal, "when you open the box. I bet he tells you not to open it right off." This wasn't a guess. Cal knew his brother. Abra knew she was losing not only the battle, but the whole war. She began to hate this boy. In her mind, she went over the deadly retorts she knew and gave them all up in helplessness, feeling they would have no effect. She retired into silence. She walked out of the door and looked toward the house where her parents were.
"I think I'll go back," she said.
"Wait," said Cal. She turned as he came up with her.
"What do you want?"
she asked coldly.
"Don't be mad with me," he said. "You don't know what goes on here. You should see my brother's back."
His change of pace bewildered her. He never let her get set in an attitude. And he had properly read her interest in romantic situations. His voice was low and secret. She lowered her voice to match his.
"What do you mean? What's wrong with his back?"
"All scars," said Cal. "It's the Chinaman." She shivered and tensed with interest.
"What does he do? Does he beat him?"
"Worse than that," said Cal.
"Why don't you tell your father?"
"We don't dare. Do you know what would happen if we told?"
"No. What?"
He shook his head. "No." He seemed to think carefully. "I don't even dare tell you." At that moment, Lee came from the shed leading the Bacon's horse, hitched to the high spindly rig with rubber tires. Mr. and Mrs. Bacon came out of the house, and automatically they all looked up at the sky. Cal said, "I can't tell you now. The Chinaman would know if I told." Mrs. Bacon called, "Abra, hurry, we're going." Lee held the restive horse while Mrs. Bacon was helped up into the rig. Aaron came dashing around the house carrying a cardboard box intricately tied with string and fancy bow knots. He thrust it at Abra.
"Here," he said. "Don't untie it until you get home."
Cal saw revulsion on Abra's face. Her hands shrank away from the box. "Take it, dear," her father said. "Hurry, we're very late." He thrust the box into her hands. Cal stepped closer to her.
"I want to whisper," he said.
He put his mouth to her ear.
"You've wet your pants," he said.
She blushed and pulled the sunbonnet up over her head. Mrs. Bacon picked her up under the arms and passed her into the buggy. Lee and Adam and the twins watched the horse pick up a fine trot. Before the first turn, Abra's hand came up, and the box went sailing backward into the road. Cal watched his brother's face and saw misery come into Aaron's eyes. When Adam had gone back into the house and Lee was moving out with a pan of grain to feed the chickens, Cal put his arm around his brother's shoulders and hugged him reassuringly.
"I wanted to marry her," Aaron said. "I put a letter in the box asking her."
"Don't be sad," said Cal. "I'm going to let you use my rifle." Aaron's head jerked around.
"You haven't got a rifle."
"Haven't I?" Cal said. "Haven't I, though?"
This ends Disc 13. East of Eden, Disc 14.
Chapter 28. It was at the supper table that the boys discovered the change in their father. They knew him as a presence, as ears that heard but didn't listen, eyes that looked and didn't notice. He was a cloud of a father. The boys had never learned to tell him of their interests and discoveries or of their needs. Lee had been their contact with the adult world. And Lee had managed not only to raise, feed, clothe, and discipline the boys, but he had also given them a respect for their father. He was a mystery to the boys, and his word, his law, was carried down by Lee, who naturally made it up himself and ascribed it to Adam. This night, the first after Adam's return from Salinas, Cal and Aaron were first astonished and then a little embarrassed to find that Adam listened to them and asked questions, looked at them and saw them. The change made them timid. Adam said, "I hear you were hunting today." The boys became cautious, as humans always are, faced with a new situation. After a pause, Aaron admitted,
"Yes, sir."
"Did you get anything?" This time a longer pause, and then,
"Yes, sir."
"What did you get?"
"A rabbit."
"With bows and arrows? Who got him?" Aaron said,
"We both shot. We don't know which one hit."
Adam said, "You don't know your own arrows? We used to mark our arrows when I was a boy." This time Aaron refused to answer and get into trouble. And Cal, after waiting, said,
"Well, it was my arrow, all right, but we think it might have got in Aaron's quiver."
"What makes you think that?"
"I don't know," Cal said, "but I think it was Aaron hit the rabbit."
Adam swung his eyes.
"And what do you think?" "I think maybe I hit it, but I'm not sure."
"Well, you both seem to handle the situation very well." The alarm went out of the faces of the boys. It didn't seem to be a trap.
"Where is the rabbit?"
Adam asked.
Cal said, "Aaron gave it to Abra as a present."
"She threw it out," said Aaron.
"Why?"
"I don't know. I wanted to marry her, too."
"You did?"
"Yes, sir."
"How about you, Cal?"
"I guess I'll let Aaron have her," said Cal.
Adam laughed, and the boys couldn't recall ever having heard him laugh.
"Is she a nice little girl?" he asked.
"Oh, yes," said Aaron. "She's nice, all right.
She's good and nice.
Well, I'm glad of that if she's going to be my daughter-in-law.
Lee cleared the table, and after a quick rattling in the kitchen, he came back.
Ready to go to bed?
He asked the boys. They glared in protest. Adam said,
Sit down and let them stay a while.
I've got the accounts together. We can go over them later, said Lee.
What accounts, Lee?
The house and ranch accounts. You said you wanted to know where you stood.
Not the accounts for over 10 years, Lee.
You never wanted to be bothered before.
I guess that's right. But sit a while.
Aaron wants to marry the little girl who was here today.
Are they engaged?
Lee asked him.
I don't think she's accepted him yet, said Adam. That may give us some time.
Cal had quickly lost his awe of the changed feeling in the house and had been examining this anthill with calculating eyes, trying to determine just how to kick it over. He made his decision.
She's a real nice girl, he said. I like her. You know why? Well, she said to ask you where our mother's grave is so we can take some flowers.
Could we, Father?
Aaron asked.
She said she'd teach us how to make wreaths.
Adam's mind raced. He wasn't good at lying to begin with, and he hadn't practiced. The solution frightened him. It came so quickly to his mind and so glibly to his tongue. Adam said,
I wish we could do that, boys, but I'll have to tell you, your mother's grave is clear across the country where she came from.
Why?
Aaron asked.
Well, some people want to be buried in the place they came from.
How did she get there?
Cal asked.
We put her on a train and sent her home, didn't we, Lee?
Lee nodded. It's the same with us, he said. Nearly all Chinese get sent home to China after they die.
I know that, said Aaron. You told us that before.
Did I?
Lee asked.
Sure you did, said Cal.
He was vaguely disappointed. Adam quickly changed the subject.
Mr. Bacon made a suggestion this afternoon, he began. I'd like you boys to think about it.
He said it might be better for you if we moved to Salinas. Better schools and lots of other children to play with. The thought stunned the twins. Cal asked,
How about here?
Well, we'd keep the ranch in case we want to come back.
Aaron said, Abra lives in Salinas.
And that was enough for Aaron. Already he had forgotten the sailing box. All he could think of was a small apron and a sunbonnet and soft little fingers.
Adam said, Well, you think about it. Maybe you should go to bed now.
Why didn't you go to school today?
The teacher's sick, said Aaron.
Lee verified it. Miss Cope has been sick for 3 days, he said. They don't have to go back until Monday. Come on, boys. They followed him obediently from the room. Adam sat smiling vaguely at the lamp and tapping his knee with a forefinger until Lee came back. Adam said, Do they know anything?
I don't know, said Lee.
Well, maybe it was just the little girl. Lee went to the kitchen and brought back a big cardboard box.
Here are the accounts. Every year has a rubber band around it.
I've been over it. It's complete.
You mean all accounts?
Lee said.
You'll find a book for each year and receipted bills for everything. You wanted to know how you stood. Here it is, all of it.
Do you really think you'll move?
Well, I'm thinking of it.
I wish there was some way you could tell the boys the truth.
That'd rob them of good thoughts about their mother, Lee.
Have you thought of the other danger?
What do you mean?
Well, suppose they find out the truth. Plenty of people know.
Well, maybe when they're older, it'll be easier for them.
I don't believe that, said Lee. But that's not the worst danger.
I guess I don't follow you, Lee.
It's the lie I'm thinking of. It might infect everything. If they ever found out you'd lied to them about this, the true things would suffer. They wouldn't believe anything then.
Yes, I see. But what can I tell them? I couldn't tell them the whole truth. Maybe you can tell them a part-truth, enough so that you won't suffer if they find out. I'll have to think about that, Lee. If you go to live in Salinas, it will be more dangerous. I'll have to think about it. Lee went on insistently. My father told me about my mother when I was very little, and he didn't spare me. He told me a number of times as I was growing. Of course, it wasn't the same, but it was pretty dreadful. I'm glad he told me, though. I wouldn't like not to know. Do you want to tell me? No, I don't want to. But it might persuade you to make some change for your own boys. Maybe if you just said she went away and you don't know where. But I do know. Yes, there's the trouble. It's bound to be all truth or part lie. Well, I can't force you. I'll think about it, said Adam. What's the story about your mother? You really want to hear? Only if you want to tell me. I'll make it very short, said Lee. My first memory is of living in a little dark shack alone with my father in the middle of a potato field, and with it the memory of my father telling me the story of my mother. His language was Cantonese, but whenever he told the story, he spoke in high and beautiful Mandarin. All right, then. I'll tell you. And Lee looked back in time. I'll have to tell you first that when you built the railroads in the West, the terrible work of grading and laying ties and spiking the rails was done by many thousands of Chinese. They were cheap, they worked hard, and if they died, no one had to worry. They were recruited largely from Canton, for the Cantonese are short and strong and durable, and also they are not quarrelsome. They were brought in by contract, and perhaps the history of my father was a fairly typical one. You must know that a Chinese must pay all of his debts on or before our New Year's Day. He starts every year clean. If he doesn't, he loses face. But not only that, his family loses face. There are no excuses. That's not a bad idea, said Adam. Well, good or bad, that's the way it was. My father had some bad luck. He could not pay a debt. The family met and discussed the situation. Ours is an honorable family. The bad luck was nobody's fault, but the unpaid debt belonged to the whole family. They paid my father's debt, and then he had to repay them, and that was almost impossible. One thing the recruiting agents for the railroad companies did, they paid down a lump of money on the signing of the contract. In this way, they caught a great many men who had fallen into debt. All of this was reasonable and honorable. There was only one black sorrow. My father was a young man, recently married, and his tie to his wife was very strong and deep and warm, and hers to him must have been overwhelming. Nevertheless, with good manners, they said goodbye in the presence of the heads of the family. I have often thought that perhaps good formal manners may be a cushion against heartbreak. The herds of men went like animals into the black hold of a ship, there to stay until they reached San Francisco 6 weeks later. And you can imagine what those holds were like. The merchandise had to be delivered in some kind of working condition, so it was not mistreated. And my people have learned through the ages to live close together, to keep clean and fed under intolerable conditions. They were a week at sea before my father discovered my mother. She was dressed like a man, and she had braided her hair in a man's queue. By sitting very still and not talking, she hadn't been discovered. And of course there were no examinations or vaccinations then. She moved her mat close to my father. They couldn't talk except mouth to ear in the dark. My father was angry at her disobedience, but he was glad, too. Well, there it was. They were condemned to hard labor for 5 years. It didn't occur to them to run away once they were in America, for they were honorable people, and they had signed the contract. Lee paused. I thought I could tell it in a few sentences, he said. But you don't know the background. I'm going to get a cup of water. Do you want some? Yes, said Adam. But there's one thing I don't understand. How could a woman do that kind of work?
I'll be back in a moment, said Lee, and he went to the kitchen. He brought back 10 cups of water and put them on the table. He asked, Now, what did you want to know? How could your mother do a man's work? Lee smiled. My father said she was a strong woman, and I believe a strong woman may be stronger than a man, particularly if she happens to have love in her heart. I guess a loving woman is almost indestructible.
Adam made a wry grimace. Lee said,
You'll see one day. You'll see.
I didn't mean to think badly, said Adam. How could I know out of one experience?
Go on.
One thing my mother didn't whisper in my father's ear during that long, miserable crossing, and because a great many were deadly seasick, no remark was made of her illness.
Adam cried. She was pregnant.
She was pregnant, said Lee, and she didn't want to burden my father with more worries.
Did she know about it when she started?
No, she didn't. I set my presence in the world at the most inconvenient time.
It's a longer story than I thought.
Well, you can't stop now, said Adam.
No, I suppose not.
In San Francisco, the flood of muscle and bone flowed into cattle cars, and the engines puffed up the mountains. They were going to dig hills aside in the Sierras and burrow tunnels under the peaks. My mother got herded into another car, and my father didn't see her until they got to their camp on a high mountain meadow. It was very beautiful, with green grass and flowers and the snow mountains all around. And only then did she tell my father about me. They went to work. A woman's muscles harden just as a man's do, and my mother had a muscular spirit, too. She did the pick and shovel work expected of her, and it must have been dreadful. But a panic worry settled on them about how she was going to have the baby.
Adam said, Were they ignorant? Why couldn't she have gone to the boss and told him she was a woman and pregnant? Surely they would have taken care of her.
You see, said Lee, I haven't told you enough, and that's why this is so long. They weren't ignorant. These human cattle were imported for one thing only, to work. When the work was done, those who weren't dead were to be shipped back. Only males were brought, no females. The country did not want them breeding. A man and a woman and a baby have a way of digging in, of pulling the earth where they are about them and scratching out a home. And then it takes all hell to root them out. But a crowd of men, nervous, lusting, restless, half-sick with loneliness for women, why, they'll go anywhere, and particularly will they go home. And my mother was the only woman in this pack of half-crazy, half-savage men. The longer the men worked and ate, the more restless they became. To the bosses, they weren't people but animals, which could be dangerous if not controlled. You can see why my mother didn't ask for help. Why, they'd have rushed her out of the camp and, who knows, perhaps shot and buried her like a diseased cow. 15 men were shot for being a little mutinous. No, they kept order the only way our poor species has ever learned to keep order. We think there must be better ways, but we never learn them. Always the whip, the rope, and the rifle. I wish I hadn't started to tell you this.
Why shouldn't you tell me? Adam asked.
I can see my father's face when he told me. An old misery comes back, raw and full of pain. Telling it, my father had to stop and gain possession of himself. And when he continued, he spoke sternly, and he used hard, sharp words, almost as though he wanted to cut himself with them. These two managed to stay close together by claiming she was my father's nephew. The months went by, and fortunately for them there was very little abdominal swelling, and she worked in pain and out of it. My father could only help her a little, apologizing. My nephew is young and his bones are brittle. They had no plan. They didn't know what to do. And then my father figured out a plan. They would run into the high mountains, to one of the higher meadows, and there beside a lake they would make a burrow for the birthing. And when my mother was safe and the baby born, my father would come back and take his punishment. And he would sign for an extra 5 years to pay for his delinquent nephew. Pitiful as their escape was, it was all they had, and it seemed a brightness. The plan had two requirements. The timing had to be right, and a supply of food was necessary. Lee said, "My parents." And he stopped, smiling over his use of the word, and it felt so good that he warmed it up. "My dear parents," began to make their preparations. They saved a part of their daily rice and hid it under their sleeping mats. My father found a length of string and filed out a hook from a piece of wire, for there were trout to be caught on the mountain lakes. He stopped smoking to save the matches issued. And my mother collected every tattered scrap of cloth she could find and unraveled edges to make thread and sewed this rag bag together with a splinter to make swaddling clothes for me. I wish I had known her.
So do I, said Adam.
Did you ever tell this to Sam Hamilton?
No, I didn't. I wish I had. He loved a celebration of the human soul. Such things were like a personal triumph to him.
I hope they got there, said Adam.
I know.
And when my father would tell me, I would say to him,
Get to that lake. Get my mother there. Don't let it happen again, not this time. Just once let's tell it how you got to the lake and built a house of fir boughs.
And my father became very Chinese then. He said, There's more beauty in the truth, even if it is dreadful beauty. The storytellers at the city gate twist life so that it looks sweet to the lazy and the stupid and the weak. And this only strengthens their infirmities and teaches nothing, cures nothing, nor does it let the heart soar.
Get on with it, Adam said irritably.
Lee got up and went to the window, and he finished the story, looking out at the stars that winked and blew in the March wind. A little boulder jumped down the hill and broke my father's leg. They set the leg and gave him cripple's work, straightening used nails with a hammer on a rock. And whether with worry or work, it doesn't matter, my mother went into early labor. And then the half-mad men knew, and they all went mad. One hunger sharpened another hunger, and one crime blotted out the one before it. And the little crimes committed against those starving men flared into one gigantic maniac crime. My father heard the shout, Woman! And he knew. He tried to run, and his leg rebroke under him, and he crawled up the ragged slope to the roadbed where it was happening. When he got there, a kind of sorrow had come over the sky, and the Canton men were creeping away to hide and forget that men can be like this. My father came to her on the pile of shale. She had not even eyes to see out of, but her mouth still moved, and she gave him his instructions. My father clawed me out of the tattered meat of my mother with his fingernails. She died on the shale in the afternoon. Adam was breathing hard. Lee continued in a sing-song cadence. Before you hate those men, you must know this. My father always told it at the last. No child ever had such care as I. The whole camp became my mother. It is a beauty, a dreadful kind of beauty. And now, good night. I can't talk anymore.
Adam restlessly opened drawers and looked up at the shelves and raised the lids of boxes in his house, and at last he was forced to call Lee back and ask, Where's the ink and the pen?
You don't have any, said Lee. You haven't written a word in years. I'll lend you mine if you want.
He went to his room and brought back a squat bottle of ink and a stub pen and a pad of paper and an envelope and laid them on the table. Adam asked,
How do you know I want to write a letter?
You're going to try to write to your brother, aren't you?
That's right.
It'll be a hard thing to do after so long, said Lee. And it was hard. Adam nibbled and munched on the pen, and his mouth made strained grimaces. Sentences were written and the page thrown away, and another started. Adam scratched his head with a penholder.
Lee, if I wanted to take a trip east, would you stay with the twins until I get back?
It's easier to go than to write, said Lee.
Sure, I'll stay.
No, I'm going to write.
Why don't you ask your brother to come out here?
Say, that's a good idea, Lee. I didn't think of it.
It also gives you a reason for writing, and that's a good thing.
The letter came fairly easily then, was corrected and copied fair. Adam read it slowly to himself before he put it in the envelope.
Dear Brother Charles, it said, you will be surprised to hear from me after so long. I've thought of writing many times, but you know how a man puts it off. I wonder how this letter finds you. I trust in good health. For all I know, you may have 5 or even 10 children by now. Ha ha. I have 2 sons, and they are twins. Their mother is not here. Country life didn't agree with her. She lives in a town nearby, and I see her now and then. I've got a fine ranch, but I'm ashamed to say I don't keep it up very well. Maybe I will do better from now on. I always did make good resolutions, but for a number of years I felt poorly. I am well now. How are you, and how do you prosper? I would like to see you. Why don't you come to visit here? It is a great country, and you might even find a place where you would like to settle. No cold winters here. That makes a difference to old men like us. Ha ha. Well, Charles, I hope you will think about it and let me know. The trip would do you good. I want to see you. I have much to tell you that I can't write down. Well, Charles, write me a letter and tell me all the news of the old home. I suppose many things have happened. As you get older, you hear mostly about people you knew that died. I guess that is the way of the world. Write quick and tell me if you will come to visit. Your brother, Adam.
He sat holding the letter in his hand and looking over it at his brother's dark face with its scarred forehead. Adam could see the glinting heat in the brown eyes, and as he looked, he saw the lips writhe back from the teeth and the blind, destructive animal take charge. He shook his head to rid his memory of the vision, and he tried to rebuild the face, smiling. He tried to remember the forehead before the scar, but he couldn't bring either into focus. He seized the pen and wrote below his signature, P.S. Charles, I never hated you, no matter what. I always loved you, because you were my brother. Adam folded the letter and forced the creases sharp with his fingernails. He sealed the envelope flat with his fist.
Lee, he called. Oh, Lee.
The Chinese looked in through the door.
Lee, how long does it take a letter to go east? Clear east.
I don't know, said Lee.
2 weeks, maybe.
Chapter 29. After his first letter to his brother in over 10 years was mailed, Adam became impatient for an answer. He forgot how much time had elapsed. Before the letter got as far as San Francisco, he was asking aloud in Lee's hearing,
I wonder why he doesn't answer. Maybe he's mad at me for not writing. But he didn't write either. No, he didn't know where to write. Maybe he's moved away.
Lee answered, It's only been gone a few days. Give it time. I wonder whether he would really come out here, Adam asked himself. And he wondered whether he wanted Charles. Now that the letter was gone, Adam was afraid Charles might accept. He was like a restless child whose fingers stray to every loose article. He interfered with the twins, asked them innumerable questions about school.
Well, what did you learn today?
Nothing.
Oh, come, you must have learned something. Did you read?
Yes, sir.
What did you read?
That old one about the grasshopper and the ant.
Well, that's interesting.
There's one about an eagle carries a baby away.
Yes, I remember that one. I forget what happens.
We aren't to it yet. We saw the pictures.
The boys were disgusted. During one of Adam's moments of fatherly bungling, Cal borrowed his pocket knife, hoping he would forget to ask for it back. But the sap was beginning to run freely in the willows. The bark would slip easily from a twig. Adam got his knife back to teach the boys to make willow whistles, a thing Lee had taught them 3 years before. To make it worse, Adam had forgotten how to make the cut. He couldn't get a peep out of his whistles. At noon one day, Will Hamilton came roaring and bumping up the road in a new Ford. The engine raced in its low gear, and the high top swayed like a storm-driven ship. The brass radiator and the Prestolite tank on the running board were blinding with brass polish. Will pulled up the brake lever, turned the switch straight down, and sat back in the leather seat. The car backfired several times without ignition because it was overheated. "Here she is," Will called with a false enthusiasm. He hated Fords with a deadly hatred. But they were daily building his fortune. Adam and Lee hung over the exposed insides of the car while Will Hamilton, puffing under the burden of his new fat, explained the workings of a mechanism he didn't understand himself. It's now hard to imagine the difficulty of learning to start, drive, and maintain an automobile. Not only was the whole process complicated, but one had to start from scratch. Today's children breathe in the theory, habits, and idiosyncrasies of the internal combustion engine in their cradles. But then you started with the blank belief that it would not run at all, and sometimes you were right. Also, to start the engine of a modern car, you do just two things: turn a key and touch the starter. Everything else is automatic. The process used to be more complicated. It required not only a good memory, a strong arm, an angelic temper, and a blind hope, but also a certain amount of practice of magic, so that a man about to turn the crank of a Model T might be seen to spit on the ground and whisper a spell. Will Hamilton explained the car and went back and explained it again. His customers were wide-eyed, interested as terriers, cooperative, and didn't interrupt. But as he began for the third time, Will saw that he was getting no place. "Tell you what," he said brightly. "You see, this isn't my line. I wanted you to see her and listen to her before I made delivery. Now I'll go back to town, and tomorrow I'll send out this car with an expert. And he'll tell you more in a few minutes than I could in a week. But I just wanted you to see her." Will had forgotten some of his own instructions. He cranked for a while and then borrowed a buggy and a horse from Adam and drove to town. But he promised to have a mechanic out the next day. There was no question of sending the twins to school the next day. They wouldn't have gone. The Ford stood tall and aloof and dour under the oak tree where Will had stopped it. Its new owners circled it and touched it now and then, the way you touch a dangerous horse to soothe him. Lee said, "I wonder whether I'll ever get used to it." "Of course you will," Adam said without conviction. "Why, you'll be driving all over the county first thing you know." "I will try to understand it," Lee said, "but drive it I will not." The boys made little dives in and out to touch something and leap away. "What's this doohickey, Father?" "Get your hands off that." "But what's it for?" "I don't know, but don't touch it. You don't know what might happen." "Didn't the man tell you?"
"I don't remember what he said. Now, you boys get away from it or I'll have to send you to school. Do you hear me, Cal? Don't open that."
They had got up and were ready very early in the morning. By 11 o'clock, hysterical nervousness had set in.
The mechanic drove up in the buggy in time for the midday meal. He wore box-toed shoes and Duchess trousers, and his wide square coat came almost to his knees. Beside him in the buggy was a satchel in which were his working clothes and tools. He was 19 and chewed tobacco, and from his 3 months in automobile school, he had gained a great, though weary, contempt for human beings. He spat and threw the lines at Lee.
"Put this hay burner away," he said. "How do you tell which end is the front?"
And he climbed down from the rig as an ambassador comes out of a state train. He sneered at the twins and turned coldly to Adam.
"I hope I'm in time for dinner," he said.
Lee and Adam stared at each other. They had forgotten about the noonday meal. In the house, the godling grudgingly accepted cheese and bread and cold meat and pie and coffee and a piece of chocolate cake.
"I'm used to a hot dinner," he said. "You better keep those kids away if you want any car left."
After a leisurely meal and a short rest on the porch, the mechanic took his satchel into Adam's bedroom. In a few minutes, he emerged, dressed in striped overalls and a white cap which had Ford printed on the front of its crown.
"Well," he said, "done any studying?"
"Studying?" Adam asked.
"Ain't you even read the literature in the book under the seat?"
"I didn't know it was there," said Adam.
"Oh, Lord," said the young man disgustedly.
With a courageous gathering of his moral forces, he moved with decision toward the car.
"Might as well get started," he said. "God knows how long it's going to take if he ain't studied."
Adam said, "Mr. Hamilton couldn't start it last night."
"He always tries to start it on the magneto," said the sage. All right, come along."
"Know the principles of an internal combustion engine?"
"No," said Adam. "Oh, Jesus Christ."
He lifted the tin flaps.
"This here is an internal combustion engine," he said.
Lee said quietly, "So young to be so erudite." The boy swung around toward him, scowling.
"What did you say?"
he demanded, and he asked Adam,
"What did the chink say?"
Lee spread his hands and smiled blandly.
"Say, very smart fella,"
he observed quietly.
"Maybe go college. Very wise."
"Just call me Joe,"
the boy said for no reason at all, and he added,
"College? What do them fellas know? Can they set a timer, huh? Can they file a point? College."
And he spat a brown, disparaging comment on the ground. The twins regarded him with admiration, and Cal collected spit on the back of his tongue to practice. Adam said,
"Lee was admiring your grasp of the subject."
The truculence went out of the boy, and a magnanimity took its place.
"Just call me Joe," he said. "I ought to know it. Went to automobile school in Chicago. That's a real school, not like no college."
And he said,
"My old man says you take a good chink, I mean a good one, why, he's about as good as anybody. They're honest."
"But not the bad ones," said Lee.
"Hell no. Not no highbinders or nothing like that, but good chinks."
"I hope I may be included in that group."
"You look like a good chink to me. Just call me Joe."
Adam was puzzled at the conversation, but the twins weren't. Cal said experimentally to Aaron,
"Just call me Joe."
And Aaron moved his lips, trying out, "Just call me Joe." The mechanic became professional again, but his tone was kinder. An amused friendliness took the place of his former contempt.
"This here," he said, "is an internal combustion engine."
They looked down at the ugly lump of iron with a certain awe. Now the boy went on so rapidly that the words ran together into a great song of the new era.
"Operates through the explosion of gases in an enclosed space. Power of explosion is exerted on piston and through connecting rod and crankshaft, through transmission, thence to rear wheels. Got that?"
They nodded blankly, afraid to stop the flow. There's two kinds, two-cycle and four-cycle. This here is four-cycle. Got that?
Again they nodded. The twins, looking up into his face with adoration, nodded.
That's interesting, said Adam.
Joe went on hurriedly.
Main difference of a Ford automobile from other kinds is its planetary transmission, which operates on a revolutionary principle.
He pulled up for a moment, his face showing strain. And when his four listeners nodded again, he cautioned them.
Don't get the idea you know it all. The planetary system is, don't forget, revolutionary. You better study up on it in the book. Now, if you got all that, we'll go on to the operation of the automobile.
He said this in bold-faced type, capital letters. He was obviously glad to be done with the first part of his lecture, but he was no gladder than his listeners. The strain of concentration was beginning to tell on them, and it was not made any better by the fact that they had not understood one single word.
Come around here, said the boy. Now, you see that there? That's the ignition key. When you turn that there, you're ready to go ahead. Now, you push this doohickey to the left, that puts her on battery. See, where it says bat? That means battery.
They craned their necks into the car. The twins were standing on the running board.
No, wait, I got ahead of myself. First, you got to retard the spark and advance the gas, else you'll kick your goddamn arm off. This here, see it? This here is the spark. You push it up. Get it? Up. Clear up. And this here is the gas. You push her down. Now, I'm going to explain it, and then I'm going to do it. I want you to pay attention. You kids, get off the car. You're in my light. Get down, goddammit.
The boys reluctantly climbed down from the running board. Only their eyes looked over the door. He took a deep breath.
Now, you ready? Spark retarded, gas advanced. Spark up, gas down. Now switch to battery. Left. Remember, left.
A buzzing like that of a gigantic bee sounded.
Hear that? That's the contact in one of the coil boxes. If you don't get that, you got to adjust the points or maybe file them.
He noticed a look of consternation on Adam's face.
You can study up on that in the book, he said kindly.
He moved to the front of the car.
Now this here is the crank, and see this little wire sticking out of the radiator? That's the choke. Now watch careful while I show you. You grab the crank like this and push till she catches. See how my thumb is turned down? If I grabbed her the other way with my thumb around her and she was to kick, well, she'd knock my thumb off. Got it?
He didn't look up, but he knew they were nodding.
Now, he said, look careful. I push in and bring her up until I got compression. And then, why, I pull out this wire and I bring her around careful to suck gas in. Hear that sucking sound? That's choke. But don't pull her too much or you'll flutter. Now, I let go the wire, and I give her a hell of a spin, and as soon as she catches, I run around and advance the spark and retard the gas, and I reach over and throw the switch quick over to Magneto. See where it says mag? And there you are.
His listeners were limp. After all this, they had just got the engine started. The boy kept at them.
I want you to say after me now so you learn it. Spark up. Gas down.
They repeated in chorus.
Spark up, gas down. Switch to bat. Switch to bat. Crank to compression, thumb down. Crank to compression, thumb down. Easy over, choke out. Easy over, choke out. Spinner. Spinner. Spark down, gas up. Spark down, gas up. Switch to mag. Switch to mag. Now, we'll go over her again. Just call me Joe. Just call you Joe. Not that. Spark up, gas down.
A kind of weariness settled on Adam as they went over the litany for the fourth time. The process seemed silly to him. He was relieved when a short time later, Will Hamilton drove up in his low, sporty red car. The boy looked at the approaching vehicle. "That there's got 16 valves," he said in a reverent tone. "Special job." Will leaned out of his car. "How's it going?" he asked. "Just fine," said the mechanic. "They catch on quick." "Look, Roy, I gotta take you in. The new hearse knocked out a bearing. You'll have to work late to get it ready for Mrs. Hawks at 11 tomorrow." Roy snapped to efficient attention. "I'll get my clothes," he said, and ran for the house. As he tore back with his satchel, Cal stood in his way. "Hey," Cal said, "I thought your name was Joe." "How do you mean, Joe?" "You told us to call you Joe. Mr. Hamilton says you're Roy." Roy laughed and jumped into the roadster. "Know why I say call me Joe?" "No, why?" "Because my name is Roy." In the midst of his laughter, he stopped and said sternly to Adam, "You get that book under the seat and you study up, hear me?" "I will," said Adam. Chapter 30. Even as in biblical times, there were miracles on the earth in those days. 1 week after the lesson, a Ford bumped up the main street of King City and pulled to a shuddering stop in front of the post office. Adam sat at the wheel with Lee beside him and the two boys straight and grand in the back seat. Adam looked down at the floorboards and all four chanted in unison, "Brake on! Advance gas! Switch off!" The little engine roared and then stopped. Adam sat back for a moment, limp but proud, before he got out. The postmaster looked out between the bars of his golden grill. "I see you've got one of the damn things," he said. "Have to keep up with the times," said Adam. "I predict there'll come a time when you can't find a horse, Mr. Trask." "Maybe so. They'll change the face of the countryside. They get their clatter into everything," the postmaster went on. "We even feel it here. Man used to come for his mail once a week. Now he comes every day, sometimes twice a day. He just can't wait for his damn catalog. Running around, always running around." He was so violent in his dislike that Adam knew he hadn't bought a Ford yet. It was a kind of jealousy coming out. "I wouldn't have one around," the postmaster said. And this meant that his wife was Adam to buy one. It was the woman who put the pressure on. Social status was involved. The postmaster angrily shuffled through the letters from the T-box and tossed out a long envelope. "Well, I'll see you in the hospital," he said viciously. Adam smiled at him and took his letter and walked out. A man who gets few letters doesn't open one lightly. He hefts it for weight, reads the name of the sender on the envelope and the address, looks at the handwriting, and studies the postmark and the date. Adam was out of the post office and across the sidewalk to his Ford before he had done all these things. The left-hand corner of the envelope had printed on it, "Bellows and Harvey, Attorneys at Law," and their address was the town in Connecticut from which Adam had come. He said in a pleasant tone, "Well, I know Bellows and Harvey. Know them well. I wonder what they want." He looked closely at the envelope. "I wonder how they got my address." He turned the envelope over and looked at the back. Lee watched him, smiling. "Maybe the questions are answered in the letter." "I guess so," Adam said. Once having decided to open the letter, he took out his pocket knife, opened the big blade, and inspected the envelope for a point of ingress. Found none, held the letter up to the sun to make sure not to cut the message, tapped the letter to one end of the envelope, and cut off the other end. He blew in the end and extracted the letter with two fingers. He read the letter very slowly. "Mr. Adam Trask, King City, California. Dear Sir," it began testily, "for the last 6 months we have exhausted every means of locating you. We have advertised in newspapers all over the country without success. It was only when your letter to your brother was turned over to us by the local postmaster that we were able to ascertain your whereabouts." Adam could feel their impatience with him. The next paragraph began a complete change of mood. It is our sad duty to inform you that your brother, Charles Trask, is deceased. He died of a lung ailment October 12th, after an illness of 2 weeks, and his body rests in the Oddfellow Cemetery. No stone marks his grave. We presume you will want to undertake this sorrowful duty yourself. Adam drew a deep, full breath and held it while he read the paragraph again. He breathed out slowly to keep the release from being a sigh. "My brother Charles is dead," he said. "I'm sorry," said Lee. Cal said, "Is he our uncle?" "He was your Uncle Charles," said Adam. "Mine too?" Aaron asked. "Yours too." "I didn't know we had him," Aaron said. "Maybe we can put some flowers on his grave. Abra would help us. She likes to." "It's a long way off, clear across the country," Aaron said excitedly. "I know. When we take flowers to our mother, we'll take some to our Uncle Charles." And he said a little sadly, "I wished I knew I had him before he was dead." He felt that he was growing rich in dead relatives. "Was he nice?" Aaron asked. "Very nice," said Adam. "He was my only brother, just like Cal is your only brother." "Were you twins, too?" "No, not twins." Cal asked, "Was he rich?" "Of course not," said Adam. "Where'd you get that idea?" "Well, if he was rich, we'd get it, wouldn't we?" Adam said sternly, "At the time of death, it isn't a nice thing to talk about money. We're sad because he died." "How can I be sad?" said Cal. "I never even saw him." Lee covered his mouth with his hand to conceal his smile. Adam looked back at the letter, and again it changed mood with its paragraph. "As attorneys for the deceased, it is our pleasant duty to inform you that your brother, through industry and judgment, amassed a considerable fortune, which, in land, securities, and cash, is well in excess of $100,000. His will, which was drawn and signed in this office, is in our hands and will be sent to you on your request. By its terms, it leaves all money, property, and securities to be divided equally between you and your wife. In the event that your wife is deceased, the total goes to you. The will also stipulates that if you are deceased, all property goes to your wife. We judge from your letter that you are still in the land of the living, and we wish to offer our congratulations. Your obedient servants, Bellows and Harvey, by George B. Harvey." And at the bottom of the page was scrawled, "Dear Adam, forget not thy servants in the days of thy prosperity. Charles never spent a dime. He pinched a dollar until the eagle screamed. I hope you and your wife will get some pleasure from the money. Is there an opening out there for a good lawyer? I mean myself. Your old friend, George Harvey." Adam looked over the edge of the letter at the boys and at Lee. All three were waiting for him to continue. Adam's mouth shut to a line. He folded the letter, put it in its envelope, and placed the envelope carefully in his inside pocket. "Any complications?" Lee asked.
"No. I just thought you looked concerned."
"I'm not. I'm sad about my brother."
Adam was trying to arrange the letter's information in his mind, and it was as restless as a setting hen scrounging into the nest. He felt that he would have to be alone to absorb it. He climbed into the car and looked blankly at the mechanism. He couldn't remember a single procedure. Lee asked, "Want some help?"
"Funny," said Adam. "I can't remember where to start."
Lee and the boys began softly. "Spark up, gas down, switch over to bat."
"Oh, yes, of course, of course."
And while the loud bee hummed in the coil box, Adam cranked the Ford and ran to advance the spark and throw the switch to mag. They were driving slowly up the lumpy road of the home draw under the oak trees when Lee said, "We forgot to get meat."
"Did we? I guess we did. Well, can't we have something else?"
"How about bacon and eggs?"
"That's fine. That's good."
"You'll want to mail your answer tomorrow," said Lee. You can buy meat then. I guess so, said Adam. While dinner was preparing, Adam sat staring into space. He knew